Welcome to Abnormalcy. I'm Todd Robbins. This is a podcast of true tales featuring the disquietly strange, the distressingly unusual, the unnervingly bizarre, and the maliciously beautiful. These unsettling stories are not for everyone, and yet they might be just right for you. Welcome. This episode will chronicle the dastardly deeds done by children. Evil, sinister, malevolent children. And I thought, due to the nature of this subject, I would have these stories told to you by a special guest, someone who knows a good deal about being bad, my son Phineas. Oh, Finn!
Yes, Dad?
It's all yours, my boy.
Thanks. I'll take it from here. You can go away now. Welcome. When you think of children, you're probably filled with hope for the future. And yet, throughout the years, there have been a number of bad seeds that shake one's faith of future generations. The best known in this category were the young killers Leopold and Loeb. Back in the 1920s, these two University of Chicago students set out to commit the perfect crime, but ended up murdering a 14-year-old boy in a way that lacked the perfection they sought. Leopold and Loeb were not first of their kind, and they weren't the last. Therefore, we now dive into a chaotic cavalcade of killer kids. We start off with Jesse Pomeroy. There is a very good reason that the press dubbed him the Boston Boy Fiend. He was born in 1859. By the time he was a young teenager, he was on his way to being a monster. Jesse was an odd-looking boy. He had a hair lip and had dark circles around his eyes. One of his eyes was milky white, and those dark circles made this malformed eye stand out even more. His appearance played a large role in shaping the person that Jesse would become. Kids at school found that mutant eye disturbing. They rarely interacted with Jesse, and when they did pay attention to him, it was often to bully and beat him. Home life was no better. His older brother seldom acknowledged Jesse's presence, and Jesse's alcoholic father was so repulsed by his son's haunted eye that he went out of his way to find reasons to beat Jesse. His father would have Jesse stripped naked so that the beating of him with his worn leather belt hurt even more. This instilled in Jesse an appreciation to detail when doing malevolent things to others. History has shown us that physical abuse is often a gift that keeps on giving. The abused often become the abuser of others later on, such as the case of Jesse Pomeroy. When he was about my age, 12 years old, Jesse started bringing children into the woods for sadistic purposes. On a cold September day in 1871, Jesse took a boy out into the secluded spot in the woods of Massachusetts near his home in Charleston. He stripped the boy naked, tied him to a tree, and whipped the boy unconscious with a rope. He then left the boy to fend for himself. It is not known if Jesse found erotic pleasure in doing this, or if that came later. At least a half a dozen more boys were tortured by Jesse. He didn't just whip them. No, he also stuck pins in them, cut them with a knife, and sometimes would knock their teeth out. On the 4th of July, 1872, Jesse celebrated the founding of our nation by taking a kid named Johnny Blatch out into the woods, tied him up, and beat him senseless. Jesse waited until the boy revived and gained enough strength to walk him down to the nearby creek. Jesse then washed the child's raw, bleeding wounds in salt water. Later that year, Jesse's mother packed up Jesse and his brother, left their drunkard husband behind, and moved to South Boston. It didn't take Jesse very long to continue his perversions. Because they were now in an urban area, he no longer had access to the seclusion of wooded areas. He had to adapt. He took his actions a step further by kidnapping boys, taking them to the basement of their home where Jesse would strip them, tie them up, and torture them. Because it was easy to identify location, and Jesse's easy to identify appearance. When his victims went to the authorities, they were able to easily point out Jesse as the culprit. Jesse was arrested, tried, and convicted for assault, and sentenced to a reform school for a decade. However, he was out in a year and a half. It turned out his mother had affairs with various officials and then got them to release her son early. The entire experience taught Jesse an important lesson. If you're going to do something bad, do it all the way and don't leave witnesses. In March of 1874, a 10-year-old girl named Katie Mary Curran was missing. She was last seen in a dressmaker shop on Broadway in South Boston. A $500 reward was offered for the information leading to the arrest of whoever was responsible for the girl's disappearance. Nothing came of this. A month later, two boys were looking for clams on the marshy shore of Dorchester Bay. They came upon a ditch, and there, half sunk in the mud, was a savagely mutilated corpse of a 4-year-old boy named Horace Millen. There were X's carved into his flesh. His genitals were almost severed off his body, and his throat was slit. The boys ran screaming from this horrific scene, raced home and told their parents of the gruesome discovery. The authorities were called, and there was something about this crime that reminded them of Jesse Pomeroy. The cops paid a visit to Jesse. They found him wearing clothes splattered with blood. They also found his boots by the door. They had mud on them. Mud, much like the mud of that ditch. And the boots matched the imprints they found near the crime scene. Oh, and there was also a bloody knife. They found Jesse at his mother's store. Jesse often worked there, and his mother was a dressmaker. And that shop was the last place little Katie Mary Curran was seen alive. Because of this, the police decided to look around a bit. In the basement, buried in a pile of ash, there was a lifeless body of Katie. Jesse was arrested, and yet, all the evidence they had against him was circumstantial. Jesse had been very careful, so the detectives prepared to do whatever was necessary to obtain a confession from this 14-year-old miscreant. Surprisingly, it didn't take much. They asked him if he had killed those children, and Jesse just looked at them with that dead white eye of his and said coldly, "I suppose I did." Then he went on to tell the tale of how he murdered 27 people. Jesse ended up being convicted of murder with extreme atrocity, basically murder in the first degree. And shortly after his 15th birthday, he was sentenced to be hanged. Jesse had the distinction of being the youngest person in Massachusetts to receive such a sentence. He never dangled at the end of the rope. After extended legal proceedings, his sentence was commuted to life in prison. He spent 58 years behind bars. 41 of those years he spent in solitary confinement. Solitary confinement is meant to be the most extreme punishment possible. However, Jesse had known isolation all his life, and therefore, he thrived under these conditions. Though upon his conviction, he was found to be mentally deficient, Jesse taught himself to read several foreign languages. He wrote poetry and plotted and attempted numerous failed escapes. He also studied law and made a number of legal pleas for his pardon. He never got one, though. The reason was because he never showed an ounce of remorse. And when he died in prison in 1931 at the age of 72, though he was a frail old man in ill health with that white eye, now blind, blinded by an explosion during one of his unsuccessful escape attempts, he had within him that same cruel soul that tortured boys out in the woods 60 years before. Prison is such a curious institution. Many look upon a prison as a place for criminals to reform their life and become a better person. Others view the purpose of prison as a place to just lock away harmful people to protect the public. Perhaps both descriptions are accurate. Unfortunately, those two purposes can come head to head, and those results are never good. This is something Zahid Mubarak came to understand all too well. Zahid Mubarak's family originally came from Pakistan. They lived in East London, and that was where Zahid was born in 1980 and was raised. Somewhere along the line, his life took an ugly turn. Drugs. It's not clear as to how it happened, and yet his was an all too common story. Drug addiction can distort one perception on how the world works. The line of what's mine and what's yours blurs, and you end up taking what is mine, and then you sell what's mine in order to support your heroin habit. That's what happened to Zahid. Petty crimes. Breaking into cars to sell what could be found there. 11 offenses in 10 months. He got caught and ended up with 5 counts against him. Still, there was hope for Zahid. There was no weapon involved with any of his crimes, no violence, so he was kept out of jail by his promises to meet with people running drug rehab programs and other agencies. Since the story is being told here, you can probably guess that there's no nice, happy ending. No, unfortunately, a dependency on drugs can leave a person with a lack of desire, a lack of caring for themselves and others. This seems to have been what happened to Zahid. He missed appointments with those that were trying to help him. He even missed a couple court appearances. Nothing good comes from that. On January 17th, 2000, a 19-year-old Zahid Mubarak was sentenced to 90 days at Felman Young Offenders Institute. Don't let the name of that place fool you. It's a prison, and a prison with a number of problems, especially in the way it's being run. It was overcrowded and understaffed, and the staff they did have was overworked and overwhelmed by the duties running the juvie prison. They made mistakes, and you don't want to make mistakes when running a prison. Despite this, Zahid's jail term was progressing well and seemed to be doing the very thing it was designed to do. These 90 days were a wake-up call for the young man. He had time to reflect upon the life he had led and the mistakes he made, and that nightmarish existence he had to endure every day instilled in him a determination to never return to a place like that once he was released. Perhaps it was the excitement of getting out and starting a new life that kept Zahid from sleeping well the night before he was to be released. The light in the cell bothered him, so he asked his cellmate to turn it off. Instead, the cellmate threw a pair of dirty underwear over the light. Perhaps the cellmate did such a nasty thing because he was jealous that Zahid Mubarak was leaving in a few hours? No, it was much more than that. Much more. You see, at a bit after 3:30 in the morning, that cellmate got up out of his bed and quietly removed a leg from the wooden table in the cell. He then took the table leg and, using it like a club, hit the sleeping Zahid with it, and hit him with it again and again and again, over and over. It's not known if Zahid ever woke up or just lapsed directly into unconsciousness from the brutal attack. After his work was done, the cellmate put down the bloodied and splintered table leg and then ran the cell's alarm bell. When the guard arrived, the cellmate told the guard that Zahid had been in an accident. They quickly rushed the cellmate into another cell while the guards tried to keep the battered Zahid from dying. The cellmate quietly cleaned himself off, washing the splattered blood in order to remove the evidence of this heinous act. Zahid was rushed to a nearby hospital, and it was there, 4 hours later, at about the same time that he had been scheduled to be released, Zahid Mubarak died. He had entered that prison to serve a 3-month sentence for having committed a handful of petty, nonviolent crimes, and 90 days later, he came out of there dead. There's a curious detail about this murder. Why did the cellmate ring the alarm after he bludgeoned Zahid? He could have just climbed back into bed and left Zahid to die there, but he didn't. Was he trying to be helpful by pulling that alarm? No one really knows. The perp has never talked about it. Joshua Phillips was trying to be helpful when he joined a 400-volunteer search party to help find the missing Maddie Clifton back in 1998. It was the least he can do, since little Maddie was his neighbor and a friend. They searched all over Jacksonville, Florida, and all of the surrounding areas, but it was no use. She couldn't be found. It really was such a waste of time and effort, because Joshua, or Josh as friends called him, could have provided clues to her whereabouts since he was the last person to see her alive. But he didn't offer up any information, because that would get him in trouble. Get him in trouble with his father, and that's the last thing Josh wanted. Josh's father, Steve Phillips, was a dominating person, to the point of being very violent when angry. He was often angry with Josh and Josh's mother. Josh was terrified of his father and would do nothing to anger him. And this put Josh in a difficult situation in regard to the missing Maddie Clifton. Josh's father had a strict rule that no friends could come over to visit Josh while he was home alone and Josh's parents weren't around. Josh thought this was a lousy rule. I mean, he wasn't a baby. He was 14. So, when little 8-year-old Maddie came over to play, Josh didn't have any second thought about it. He grabbed a bat and a ball and they headed out into the backyard. All went well until Maddie threw the ball to Josh and Josh hit it with his bat. The ball flew right into Maddie and hit her in the eye. It must have hurt like hell because Maddie started screaming. Josh tried to get her to stop crying, but it was no use. She was hysterical. Josh began to panic. His father was going to be home soon, and Josh was going to catch hell for having someone over. It was going to be awful. It was going to be painful. Very painful. Josh had to do something. He couldn't suffer the consequences of having his father find a crying little girl when he got home. So, Josh had an idea. A very bad idea. He had to get Maddie to stop crying. He brought Maddie into the house, grabbed the first thing he could find, a telephone cord, wrapped it around the little girl's throat, and spent the next 15 minutes strangling her. He thought she was dead, but Maddie had a Rasputin-like resilience. When he realized she was still alive, he hit her repeatedly with his baseball bat. Now, what would he do with the body? Josh had an idea. He dragged the body into his room and stuffed her under the mattress of his waterbed. About that time, Josh's father came home. Josh came out, made some small talk, and then returned to his room. Josh was filled with fear when he heard moaning coming from under the bed. The girl was not dead. He quickly grabbed a knife and quickly stabbed her about a dozen times. That finally did the trick. Maya's parents became worried when she didn't come home. They reached out to the neighbors asking if they had seen her. When nothing came of this, the parents reached out to the authorities. They looked into the matter. And at first, the authorities thought it was a man with a history of child molestation that lived nearby, was involved. They arrested him, but he had an alibi. After that, the cops were stumped. That's when the volunteer search party was formed, and Josh joined in. What is intriguing is that Josh spent a number of nights sleeping in that waterbed with the body of the dead little girl right underneath him. About a week after Maddie disappeared, Josh's mother noticed a strange smell coming from his room. There are many strange smells to be found in the 14-year-old boy's room, but this smell was different. She investigated the source, fearing that Josh's waterbed might have had a leak in it. She looked under the mattress. What she found was the source of that foul aroma. As you can guess, it was the partially decomposed corpse of Maddie. The truth came out. Josh Phillips was arrested, tried, and convicted for the murdering of Maddie Clifton. Because he was under the age of 16, he avoided the death penalty and instead was given a life sentence without a chance of parole. There had been appeals to that sentence, but it still stands. It won't come up for review again until 2023, on the 25th anniversary of the murder of Maddie Clifton. Before we go further, there's something important you should know. The Young Killers Club is not only for boys. Oh no. Teenage girls often keep a diary. In it, they can record their innermost thoughts about boys, and life, and boys, and friends, and boys. 14-year-old Shirley Wolf kept a journal like this. Except the entry she made on June 14th, 1983, was a bit different. It read, "Today, Cindy and I ran away and killed an old lady. It was lots of fun." The Cindy that Shirley mentioned was 15-year-old Cindy Collier. Have you ever met someone for the first time and just bonded with them immediately? Well, that's what happened when Shirley and Cindy met. And they also knew immediately that they should go out and kill someone as soon as possible. One of the reasons people bond like this is because they have a similar life experience. This is true for Cindy and Shirley. They were both raped at a very young age. It happened to Cindy when she was 9. Shirley was sexually assaulted starting at the age of 2 by her father. Fortunately, he was caught after doing this to his daughter for a decade and pled guilty. For the countless crimes against her, he only spent 100 days in jail. Both Cindy and Shirley were filled with anger and had been lashing out at the world for years. They both ran away from home repeatedly, bullied their schoolmates, and committed numerous crimes such as petty theft and carjacking. The authorities knew them both very well, and the two of them both became very familiar with the inside of juvenile correction facilities. It was one of these types of places, a low-security group home near Sacramento, California, that the two girls met. They found that they were a mirror image of each other. They had only known each other for less than a day when they decided they needed to spend the rest of their life together. And they formed a plan. Cindy was the leader and came up with most of the details. The first thing they had to do was escape from their facility. That wasn't a problem at all. They had done this before. Next thing was to get as far away as possible. For this, they needed a car. That was probably going to take some force to pull off. And that was a problem. They were both teenage girls, so if they were gonna attack someone, it better be a person who wouldn't put up much of a fight. Someone old. And they would have to kill that person so there would be no witnesses. After jumping the fence at the juvie facility, the two girls made their way to a condominium development near where Cindy had lived with her family in Auburn, California. They knocked on doors, asking people if they could use their phone or have a glass of water. Most of the people they encountered sensed there was something off, something malevolent about these two girls. The people denied the request, closed and locked the doors. Most did this, but not all. Anna Brackett was a retired seamstress in her mid-80s. She was also a lousy judge of character, for she let the two girls in. Once in, the girls lost their nerve. Instead of just attacking the old woman, they sat down and had a lovely conversation with her for an hour. All was very pleasant until the phone rang. It was Anna's son, Carl. He was coming over soon to pick up his mother to take her to her weekly bingo game. When Anna hung up the phone, the two girls knew that if they were going to do this, they needed to do this right then and there. They did it. Shirley grabbed the old woman by the throat and throws her to the ground. Cindy rushes to the kitchen and finds a butcher knife. She tosses it to Shirley, who uses it to stab Anna in the neck. Anna cries out, "I'm dying!" And Shirley replies coldly, "Good." Shirley goes on to stab Anna about 30 times. The exact number is not known. The knife entered the same wounds more than once. This lethal assault does the job. Anna is dead. The girls quickly ransack the condo, stealing money, grabbing car keys, and ripping the telephones off the wall. Unfortunately for the girls, they grabbed the wrong set of keys and couldn't start Anna's car. As Anna's son was driving to his mother's house, he saw two teenage girls on the side of the road hitchhiking. Fortunately for Carl, he didn't stop to pick them up. Shirley and Cindy made their way to the nearby home of Cindy's family. There, they hide out in the basement. It was in the basement that Shirley made her journal entry talking about how much fun the murder was and how they wanted to do it again as soon as possible. They didn't get the chance. Cindy had lived in that area, and several of the residents recognized her and told the police that Cindy and another young girl were around at that time of the murder. The police still had their doubts that a couple of girls could have done such a brutal and savage act of depravity. Still, they needed to follow up on the possible lead. It didn't take the cops long to track down the girls. They found them still there in the basement. It was the middle of the night, and the officers woke up the girls to ask them if they knew anything about the killing. The answers they got shocked the cops. When asked about the murder, Shirley thought for a moment and then flatly said, "We did it. We killed her." The cops recorded her confession, and then it was Cindy's turn. She too confessed, laughing while doing so. Both of them told of the excitement of the experience. Shirley said that as she was slashing away at Anna, she was imagining that she was stabbing her father and all the others that had abused her. The girls were tried and found guilty of first-degree murder. They were thrown into prison, and though they did act up and act out while there, including crashing a fire truck during an escape attempt and assaulting prison guards, eventually the two settled down and turned their lives around. In the mid-90s, a decade after the murder, both girls were released. Cindy Collier went on to start a family. Shirley Wolfe got a degree in law and spent a lot of her time working with her church. It's not known if the people around them in these latter years have any idea that these two women were once giggling teenagers with blood on their hands. It's been 20 years since Robert Stewart did what he's most known for, and people still know who he is and what he did. Though there was one significant event in the criminal life of Robert Stewart, his career as an evil person is long and storied. Like all of the young ones profiled here, his march down the path of infamy started at a young age. Robert Stewart was from a hard-working family in Manchester, England. Father was a bricklayer, mother had a job in a factory. His schooling started off promising. Robert was at the top of his class. Unfortunately, he was not only the best at academic studies, he was also the best at being antisocial. When he did interact with his classmates, it was usually to punch someone's lights out. The only extracurricular activity he took part in involved the local fire department. He didn't work with them, he worked against them. Robert would set random fires and firemen would rush to put them out. His first conviction was at the age of 12 for arson. During the next 5 years, he racked up an impressive list of convictions for a wide spectrum of offenses, including burglary and breaking into cars, hotwiring them and taking them for a ride. It was also during his teenage years that the school system gave up on him. What led to this was Robert Stewart flooding a classroom, beating up various classmates, setting fire to a girl's hair, and breaking into the school one night and threatening the life of a teacher. That was it. His school years were over. Being expelled from school gave Robert more time to devote to being truly awful. He had 18 convictions for 70 offenses. He was bounced around from juvie facility to juvie facility. He was seen by numerous counselors, and they all came to the same conclusion. Robert Stewart was a psychopath. This was not a real revelation. During his incarceration, Robert flooded his jail cell, smeared his own excrement on the wall, covered himself in margarine, he ate soap, and put a noose around his own neck. He also got several racist gang-related prison tattoos on his face. Robert fell in with the prison gang and found a friend in a particularly bad fellow named Maurice Travis. They became good friends, and when Maurice knifed another inmate to death, Robert was close by. There's evidence to support the idea that Robert handed Maurice the knife he used in that murder. Robert and Maurice were members of a gang that were deeply racist and were cunningly evil in their own deeds. Instead of randomly killing people of color, they would wait for a date that was meaningful. One victim was murdered on their 17th birthday. Another was killed on the day of their grandmother's funeral. Robert's action did not go unnoticed. On numerous occasions, he was evaluated by psychologists. The prognosis was that Robert Stewart had a severe psychological condition that was, quote, untreatable. One report said that Robert couldn't be trusted for even a minute. Another report said that he was a disaster waiting to happen. You would think that this would put a bubble around Robert and isolate him from others. No. Robert fell into a situation that was a perfect storm for catastrophe. First off, the recommendation for Robert was that since the condition was untreatable, they shouldn't do anything about it and hope that time will change him. Ain't that cute? Second, there was a perverse game that the prison guards would play. They called it Coliseum, or Gladiator. They would intentionally put racist prisoners into cells with ethnic prisoners, and then place bets as to how long it would take for something bad to happen. Perhaps that is why Robert Stewart was placed in a cell with a young man that was from a Pakistani family? The official report is that the administrators hadn't received Robert's files when he was moved to this facility. Regardless of why he was put in the cell, the inevitable did happen. It didn't happen at first. Robert was waiting for the best moment to do something truly terrible. His cellmate knew what was coming and asked to be transferred. His request was ignored. And this gave Robert the perfect opportunity. He waited. And in the middle of the night, a few hours before his cellmate was to be released, Robert Stewart removed a broken wood leg from a table in the cell and used that leg to beat and mortally wound his cellmate, Zahid Mubarak. As mentioned before, Robert was moved into another cell when the assault was discovered. After he cleaned all of Zahid's blood off of him, Robert Stewart ripped the heel off his shoe and scrawled on the wall of the cell, "Manchester has killed me soulmate." He signed the note with a swastika. Even after he was given a life sentence for killing Zahid Mubarak, Robert didn't stop. He reached out to his brother, giving him Mubarak's family address and phone number. There had been a number of inquiries into the death of Zahid Mubarak and why it happened. These inquiries seemed to have done nothing. The conditions that led to his death, overcrowding, inept staff, and institutional racism still exist. And if anything, have gotten worse. What happened there will happen again and again and again. They say nothing lasts forever. They're referring to the good things in life. Evil never dies. Well, there you go and there you have it.
Hey, that's my line. Well, thank you, Finn. This episode marks the end of season one of Abnormalcy, but don't worry, there's much more to come. Season two will be starting very, very soon. In the meantime, if you enjoyed this podcast, encourage your friends to listen to it. And if you didn't enjoy this podcast, encourage your enemies to listen. Just encourage others to listen because misery loves company. And say, would it kill you to follow Abnormalcy on Twitter or visit the Abnormalcy Facebook page? And if you go to patreon.com/ToddRobbins and toss some coin our way, you will be rewarded with all sorts of dark joy, including exclusive videos of yours truly telling some personal murky and malicious stories. Plus, there's also some invitations coming your way for live events. So, until next time, I'm Todd Robbins, and I'll be seeing you in your nightmares.